My guest this week is Deborah Mattinson, author of Talking to a Brick Wall, How New Labour Stopped Listening to the Voter, and Why We Need a New Politics. Deborah is uniquely placed to talk about the New Labour Project. For many years, she's been running her own opinion research business, and for a quarter of a century conducted the kind of focus groups with swing voters that were extremely useful in helping New Labour refine its policies. Deborah Mattinson, you're welcome.
Hi, hello.
Focus groups have had a bad rap. Let's hear your side.
I think that focus groups provide a window on public opinion that you can't get anywhere else, really. Whether it's a politician, whether it's a company looking after a brand, you need to know what people think about you, and you need to know what they say about you when you're not in the room. So they're not a substitute for connecting and being out there with ordinary people. But an MP, for example, can run a surgery and can go along and people will talk to him or her. But what they won't do often is say the things that they would say behind their back. And a focus group helps you to understand what those things are.
Tim Bell is the name, and you mentioned him, though, who pioneered their British use in politics. That was for Mrs. Thatcher.
That's right. I think, as far as I'm aware, the first time that focus groups were used in the UK was actually by Saatchi & Saatchi, the advertising agency that Mrs. Thatcher hired. And I think Tim Bell was the first person to say, well, hang on, you know, if we were making an ad for Coca-Cola, we'd obviously test it. We'd run focus groups. And so why wouldn't we do the same for a politician? And that, so far as I'm aware, is the first time that they were used in the UK.
And Labour were not into that game at that stage, were they not?
At that point, Labour were almost prehistoric in terms of all of their marketing enterprise. You know, at this stage, we were still about to get the 1983 manifesto, the longest suicide note in history, and probably the worst marketed campaign ever. So Labour had a long way to go and a kind of very long learning curve to climb up.
There is a problem, though, here, isn't there? I mean, you can hear it even in language you use, like, you know, the language of the advertising agency. People saying there's a danger that this is what politics will become. You find out what the voters are thinking and reflect that in your policies and no more, as it were.
And what would be wrong with that?
Well, the fact is that it would exclude any dimension of leadership, any sense of politicians operating out of a vision of some kind that would have to mesh with what people needed or expressed as their needs.
Well, clearly, I mean, you know, if you had a situation where a politician who had no thoughts of his or her own and simply went out and ran a marketing exercise to find out what would make them popular, that would obviously be pretty hollow. I think people would see through that. But actually, if you run a focus group and ask them what they look for in a politician, one of the first things that they will say is authenticity. They're looking for leadership. They're looking for somebody who has values and vision. And they can see straight through that. I don't think that's how... It's not how any politician I've ever worked with has used focus groups or indeed any kind of research. But I think it's perfectly valid to be out there, to be listening to people in a fairly systematic way, and then using that to help you to understand how the land lies for the people that you're trying to represent, how they feel about things, how they see the world, and also perhaps to use it a little bit to refine your own messages. So you may have a policy that's your pet policy. You need to know how people respond to that. There may be a better or a worse way.
There is a danger. I mean, I see that. That makes sense to me. There is a danger, though, isn't there, that politicians would say, you know, will that policy fly? And even though it may be rooted in what their sort of particular philosophical beliefs are, but say, no, they don't want that, and then, you know, shift in a different direction, where, in a sense, you're taking your cue all the time. Isn't that a danger from...
Well, of course, politicians don't always do everything that focus groups suggest that they might do. Taking your, you know, would this policy or would this idea fly? One great example, and I talk about this in the book, of course, is the Iraq War. Mm. That was tested dreadfully in focus groups. You know what? The public didn't want to go to war. That was fed back to Tony Blair. I'm quite sure it wasn't me doing it. Did he listen? No.
And John Prescott as deputy leader, that was a notion that he... He insisted on against the sort of data from focus groups.
Yes, I mean, Philip Gould famously was told by Tony Blair to go back and refocus your focus groups when you know, he went back and reported.
Come back that, and tell us what we want to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar situation where I was asked To test whether or not Peter Mandelson returning to the cabinet would be a good idea. And it wasn't a particularly good idea. He was not and never has been a particularly popular public figure. Was that advice taken? No. Was it right to ignore the advice? Well, you know, you can judge. You know, it certainly got a kind of Westminster Village hit.
Central to your book is that very distinction between the Westminster Village, that small in-group crowd on the one hand, and the voters on the other hand, that often the Westminster Village is insensitive to the concerns of the wider constituency.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in the end, that is at the heart of why I wrote the book. You know, I felt that all of this kind of political landscape was unfolding, and there was a story that just wasn't being told, which was the story of the humble voter. You know, the people who mattered most, in my view, were the ones who were most often ignored and excluded from the narrative. And you had the Westminster Village kind of talking to itself about things that most people didn't know much about people they'd often not heard about, and what the voter thought was so often excluded from the debate.
What put that notion into my head just now was that I think you say that Peter Mandelson exemplifies the distinction between the two groups.
I mean, in a funny way, he almost could have been the kind of motif for the book, because he was somebody who the Westminster Village were sort of fixated by, infatuated by, and yet the voter always had a pretty sort of sceptical disregard for him. He was not an appealing politician for a whole host of reasons to the ordinary voter, whereas the Westminster Village adored him.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. I recall a book by an author whose name I can't recall, but worked for the Independent newspaper, saying that Peter's problem at the end of the day was that he had no base, no local political base when he ran into trouble the first time round, which is a kind of an analogous point. I want to hear you talk about the use of projective techniques, the kind of techniques you use where, you know, you elicit associations of various kinds. You know, what does politician X suggest to you and so on, perhaps? Yeah.
Well, the reason why you do this is because, you know, if you ask somebody what they think about something, they will give you a rational response rather than an emotional response. And we don't want the rational response. We want the emotional response. We want to understand how they really feel about something. So we ask them, the easy way to get them to do that is to get them to sort of project their feelings. So a straightforward way of doing it might be, I might say to somebody, why do you think people watch The X Factor? Now, you know, if I say, why do you watch The X Factor? They might say, well, I don't.
Right.
Yes. Or it's a load of rubbish. Yes. Ask them to, you know, to project by thinking, and that's just, that's a very simple little example. With politicians, what we're after is, again, not their rational analysis, but their kind of emotional gut feel. So, you know, the examples that everybody knows that are kind of fun but do work is, you know, if this person were an animal, what kind of animal would they be? If they were a drink, what kind of drink would they be?
Car.
If they were a car, what kind of car would they be? I mean, one of the research projects that I ran for Gordon Brown, we called Project Volvo because he was a Volvo. He was sort of solid, reliable. That was what the image that he summed up for people.
I really liked it. I thought it was spot on, the one about David Cameron. You ask somebody what David Cameron reminded them of, and they said that he reminded them of a Jaguar pretending to be a Ford Mondeo. That seems spot on.
And that was so revealing about him, because what they felt was that here was this very kind of posh bloke trying to get down with the people. I mean, the other thing they said about him was, you know, he was typical of a kind of politician who would pretend to be into football. If you say what kind of drink, they'd say, well, he would pretend to be a pint of beer, but really he'd be a gin and tonic or a glass of champagne.
Yes.
So, you know, he's somebody who is not actually an ordinary bloke, but trying to you know, to masquerade as one to win the vote.
It's funny that when you look at the, I mean, really the focus of your focus groups, if you like, the heart of them, has been the swing voters. And you say that in 1949 you had the first study. Lord Poole hired an ad agency. Is that the first example?
Yeah,
of that?
I mean, it's the first time. I did a little bit of research for the book to find out when, when politicians had first started thinking about and trying to identify this concept of the swing voter and to kind of move beyond, if you like, a political party's core vote. In particular, for the Labour Party.
So what essentially are we talking about when we talk about the swing voter?
So we're talking about a group of people who are open in the way that they vote. They are not loyal voters for
any tribal.
Not tribal. They are not. You know, they're not the core voter of any political party, and they're the people in the end who determine the outcome of any election. Yeah. They're the people who can move either
way. When you look at an electorate, what percentage are swing voters in that way, would you say, at any one time?
It sort of depends how you define them, and it depends when you are. I mean, for instance, in the last election in 2010, it was 1 million votes that Labour lost that made the difference between 2005
Sure, but without getting into that level of complication, I'm thinking if you define it, you say, depends on how you define it. Define it as someone who's guided by the current data and not tribally held beliefs, not loyalty through family or whatever, who's looking at the fresh evidence and could go one way or the other. Yeah. In any society, I wonder, what percentage of the electorate, American, Irish, British, French, would it be 5%, 10%, much less, you know?
I think that it's in numerical terms, often quite a small group.
Yes.
But I think that they reflect quite a widespread point of view. And the point is that most people are not particularly into partisan politics. So that's not to say they're not interested in politics, because they are, but they are not very interested
in it. So you're saying there are more swing voters than we imagine, is that what you're saying?
I think it represents a kind of mindset that's more widespread than often the numbers would have you think. So, yes. You know, in a given constituency, we might be talking about a relatively small number of votes that will make the difference between one party winning and another. But actually, it's a mindset that's quite widespread. And I think that in Britain, it's the dominant mindset, really.
I spoke to Philip Gould in the late 90s, and you've worked with him, you've had association with him. And he mentioned that when he went to America, that Stanley Greenberg said, he was Clinton's pollster, you have to get the middle classes.
Yeah, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
You say that Herbert Morrison in 1921 had concluded that Labour couldn't get London without the middle classes. So that's been a theme there all along.
It's never, I mean, Labour can never win an election simply with their core vote. And that's always, you know, simply, if you like, with the kind of working class vote. Equally, the Conservatives could never win just with the kind of upper middle class vote. One complication now is that 70% of the population self-define as middle class. That's a massive shift. I did a piece of work which I talk about in the book, actually, which was called Southern Discomfort, after 1992 when Labour lost, to understand the kinds of people that Labour had failed to win over. And at that time, a lot of those people, those swing voters, would have self-defined as working class. They were kind of, if you like, aspirational working class. Now, you know, sort of 18 years on, that's a much wider group who are calling themselves middle class. And I think that's quite an interesting development.
How do you distinguish between middle class and middle ground?
Ah, well, what I'm using is people's own definition.
Right.
And that's what I think is quite interesting. So the same people who in the early 90s would have defined themselves as working class, exactly the same people, are now defining themselves as middle class. So that middle class vote, it was very radical actually in Herbert Morrison's day to say, we need to go beyond the working class vote or we can't win London.
And London was always slightly ahead. In the 1920s, to say at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Whereas now, for Labour, the middle class vote is really the core vote.
The problem is, though, isn't it, whether for the Republican Party or the Labour Party here or whatever, is that the business of holding on to the core vote and expanding the base at the same time. It's a tricky thing to pull off.
Well, that is if you make the assumption that they want different things. I'm not so sure that they do, necessarily. And that, again, I think is a development that we've seen. So in the early 90s, I would have termed that kind of, if you like, the age of aspiration. People were looking to better themselves. They were looking for their children to do better than they had done. In turn, they felt they'd done better than their parents.
So, in a way, are you saying that they're all co-voters now, or else they're all... In fact, you're veering more to the notion of there are more swing voters now than
well, you know. You see, I think now, set against the economic backdrop that we're living in, rather than living in an age of aspiration, we're living in an age of insecurity, and people's needs are very different. They're not necessarily looking to better themselves. They're looking to hang on to what they've got. And I think, in a way, that means that the message that might have been a message that would appeal to a core vote for Labour is now a message that has a wider appeal.
You're very strong on the importance of the women's vote for the Labour Party. I think you single out well, I suppose 97, but 2002 in particular, wouldn't have won it. What's the state of play now, today?
Well, basically, the gender gap sort of narrowed in 2010, and Labour didn't do so well with women as it had done. I mean, Labour won in 97... because of the women's vote. That was the largest group that shifted to Labour, and it managed to hang on to that women's vote to the point where in 2005, you know, if women hadn't have had the vote, there would have been a hung parliament.
So in 2005, women carried it.
Yeah, women carried it. Yeah, if only women had voted, Labour would have had a majority of more than 100 seats, right? But in 2010, that advantage fell away to Labour's detriment.
Why do you think it did? Well, you would say they stopped New Labour stopped listening to them.
I think Labour stopped listening. I think Labour stopped listening to, you know, that group of people and to have anything very specific to say. So that what I found through, 2001, 2005, even when people were quite fed up with Labour, you know, post-Iraq and so on, I'd say, OK, you know, what's Labour actually done for you? And it was often women that could say, well, you know, help with childcare, child tax credits, could list all of the things that they felt that Labour had done, nurseries, that were very specific appeal. By 2010, they couldn't list anything very much.
What about the leaders themselves in terms of their responsiveness? Which of them was the more responsive to the data?
I would say that in the early days, probably Gordon Brown was. But I tended to work always with Gordon Brown and not so much with Tony Blair. So I'm not really in a position to answer, you know, how responsive Tony was comparatively. I can only answer that sort of anecdotally and, you know, from what I've heard. But Gordon Brown, certainly in the early days, was... I mean, I'd say he was almost addicted to focus groups, actually.
Hugo Young, in his notebooks, makes the point. It surprised me when I read it, perhaps having read your book, I'm not, that he said that Brown was the one who was concerned with surveys, focus groups, data of that kind. I thought Blair would have been the one, but apparently not.
Well,
Brown,
I tell you what I think this is. I think that Tony Blair was in a way more confident than Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown needed the shoring up. And sometimes, you know, I think quite a straightforward decision. He would say, I need focus groups on this. Sometimes the team and I would joke that, you know, we knew what the answer was. And you know, perhaps we wouldn't do the focus group. We'd just sort of go to the pub for the evening and then say, here's what they said. We didn't do that, by the way.
There is a kind of paradox in a way, though, isn't there, of the two politicians. I'm hesitating as I frame this, but that Brown would seem to be the more value-based one, although Blair, as we know, had his own no-go areas. But you see the point I'm making. In a sense, it's a surprise.
It is. It's counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yes, yes,
yeah,
that he would have that. But you have some wonderful stories about when the Americans came to work for the Labour Party, New Labour, and for Brown. And this business of telling the leader the bad news.
Yes. And, I mean, Gordon, in fairness, was often very receptive, you know, and really did want to hear. But when the going got very tough, and I'm talking now about after he became Prime Minister.
So post-2007, yeah.
Well, actually, I'm talking about 2007.
Yes, That year
that kind of not the election period.
Sure.
And suddenly things had gone very, very right for quite a while, and suddenly they went quite badly wrong. Mm. And, you know, Gordon found that difficult message to hear.
You've heard a story about Stanley Greenberg, who was, I say, had been Clinton's pollster, is delivering results. It's not good news. And you say that that Gordon said to him, berated him for delivering the data so slowly, and you add as if speeding it up would make any difference to the content
of
the message.
Yes, and being sort of ponderous.
Yes,
And he also got very hung up on the way that we were defining a particular group of voters, which was a definition that I think Stan had used previously when he'd done a sort of different groupings of voters pre 2005, and there was one that was called Southeastern middle class, and they weren't doing what Gordon wanted them to do, and so he was sort of, you know, why are we talking to these people? You know, they're never going to vote for us anyway, and we had to go away and rename that group and call them something else before he would sort of accept the, you know. But this was just a classic shoot the messenger.
What happened in the Bob Schramm, as you know, well well-known Democratic advisor, and he said, I think on that same occasion, I spoke to Ted Kennedy last night, Gordon, and he has a message for you, something to the effect that he'd give anything for another 3 years. Now, how did Brown react to that?
He didn't. No. At that point, he had sort of retreated into himself, and he was not communicative at all. Wow. So, you know, we had this weird, very tense meeting, took place at number 10, different people coming in and out. Gordon was rushed. Gordon was grumpy. I'm guessing he'd had a sort of sleepless night. And, you know, we were getting no feedback from him at all. His body language was sort of closed, you know. He almost didn't respond. And then he kind of rushed off in a flurry to meet some overseas visitor.
How tense was the period when he might have gone to the country? I think you were of the opinion that he should have gone, would have won.
I'm absolutely clear that he would have won. I mean,
so
I think
2007, 8,
2007, yeah.
Yes.
So you know, the issue is whether or not he would have lost seats. I'm quite certain that he would have won. He may have won with a smaller majority than had been achieved in 2005, and I think that is what he found unpalatable.
Didn't David Cameron, someone was reminding me recently, I'd forgotten, put it up to him, said, "Go ahead and." And go to the country.
Of course. Yes, he did.
And you think he would have won. How does he feel about that now? Subsequently, I'm sure it would be a sore thought.
So, well, yeah. I think he could hardly bear to think about it. And that's why people, including me and others, were then, if you like, kind of excluded from his inner circle. He never saw us in the same light.
Was this sort of blame the messenger?
Yes,
I think so.
I think that looking at us reminded him of a mistake that he had made, and he just didn't want to do it anymore.
And how did you feel yourself, having, you know, you've worked for so many years? I think 85, if I remember, was your
85 was the first year that I did work for the Labour Party.
So it must have been quite a disappointment for you at that
stage. Well, it was a sort of, you know, slow death. What happened was that almost overnight, I went from, you know, seeing Gordon several times a week, speaking to him on the phone maybe every day, suddenly not having that regularity of contact. At the same time, I did actually continue to do work for Labour for another year and a bit. I mean, I didn't actually stop doing work until 2009.
You had a conflict of interest issue, didn't you, where you were when you got public work? People said you're getting it because of your work for Labour and so on.
Yes. Well, that was before Gordon became Prime Minister.
Yes.
I mean, I should say it was not a conflict of interest issue in
the... No, I'm saying this was the claim at the time.
Yes, I mean, it was Guido Fawkes, the kind of, you know, right-wing blogger who, anticipating Gordon becoming Prime Minister, was sort of, you know, looking at the people around him. One of the companies that I was involved with did quite a lot of public sector work. Now, you know, anybody that does that kind of public sector work knows that it's tendered to within an inch of its life. And actually, you know, should you know the politician who might ultimately get to see these findings, it's probably a hindrance rather than a help. Yeah. But nevertheless, actually at that point when Gordon became Prime Minister, I stepped back from that company and didn't do any public sector work so that there could be no accusations of that type.
I get the impression, looking at you, listening to you, having watched you earlier, there must be a temptation to be on the go all the time, available all the time. How do you deal with that?
Well, thinking about doing that kind of political work.
Yes.
I mean, it is. That is what it's like. I mean, you know, anybody who's around a politician, particularly a senior one, will tell you that, you know, you're on call 24 hours a day. And I mean, certainly in the book, I have a number of stories where I'm doing things with my family. I've got three children.
Sure.
You know, I was shopping with my daughter, buying her a pair of jeans in Topshop. And Gordon, you know, was sort of rang me and said, I need to send you an email. And I said, I didn't say I'm in Topshop. I said, you know, I don't have access to an email. You know, I'm not near a computer at the moment. He said, oh, well, what's your fax number then? You know, it's sort of impossible that you could be out of contact. You just had to be there.
How easy would you find it if David Cameron called you? If the Tories called you and said, we want you to do some work for us, is that something you could take on without any problems in terms of your own political beliefs?
No, I couldn't. I mean,
neither would they call me. If it's simply data collection and assessment and the use of projective techniques, I mean, why should you not be available to?
Because
to
in the end, it isn't like selling a brand of, you know,
of
cola or, you know.
There's a component that is about information gathering and finessing, and you could say, well, I gather this stuff, and now here I'm presenting. Do with it. What you, I suppose, saying is you balk at the notion of helping them to that degree. Is that it?
Yes, I suppose it is. I mean, I am, and make no secret of the fact that whilst I am an independent pollster, I do work for a lot of different organisations. Yeah. My new company, I am a Labour Party member.
What does the word term, when you use your projective techniques, what does socialist conjure up today in today's world?
Gosh, I mean, I haven't actually asked that question for a long time. I'm guessing that it would have a rather old-fashioned connotation, that you wouldn't find very many ordinary members of the public who'd say, I'm a socialist. I think it would sound quite old-fashioned.
It would sound more Soviet Union than a way of organising
today.
Yeah,
it speaks
to
a bygone day, I would say, rather than how things are nowadays.
It's not a term you would have used. Do I hear the term new Labour?
Ah, well, New Labour. Now, that's another. It's an interesting paradox about New Labour, actually.
Sure.
Doing some work around the Labour leadership contest. And it seemed that the most old-fashioned thing that a Labour politician could do would be to talk about New Labour. How ironic is that?
So is there an expression, New Labour now? Is there? Jokingly only.
Yes. I mean, I think that Ed Miliband has been right to say we have to move on from New Labour. New Labour is in the past, because that is very much how voters see it. They really do.
There is the view the wrong Miliband got the job. What's your view of that?
I personally felt that Ed would be the better of the two Milibands for two reasons. Partly because, actually, I think he's a better communicator than his brother. And also because I think that he got the need for real change more than David did. I felt that David was actually still slightly looking over his shoulder to that New Labour era, whereas I think that Ed understood that voters had changed, that we were in a different world, we'd moved on, and actually there should be no sacred cows. I think he got that.
In a word, what does Labour have to do now to get back on track?
Listen.
Deborah Madison, thank you very much indeed.